What's going on in the present affects our future, our tomorrows. Did you know that RUC provides help in preparing the tomorrows for our children? We're excited to invite you to the 15th annual RUC fundraising banquet on April 9th, where we'll present The Tomorrow Show. Our banquet will be held at the Villa Milano, with festivities beginning at 5:30, dinner is at 6:30, and the program gets underway at 7. Make your reservations today at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.
Well, it's March Madness, but am I talking about basketball? Find out next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm your host here on Principles and Policies. And I will tell you right up front, I'm not talking about basketball today. The show that comes on before us, they do Christianity and sports, and I'm talking about on WLRY, not necessarily on the podcast. And you could, I'm sure if you listened to that, and I'm sure you did, that you got enough March Madness to meet your needs. What we're talking about today is I'm talking about elections, and of course we just came through primary season. I'm recording this on March 22nd, 2024 for the March 23rd, 2024 Principles and Policies program. I am going to talk about elections, but I'm not going to run over the election results. Folks, if you paid any attention at all, you already know the election results. You already know, most likely, that both declared presidential candidates, the major candidates on both sides of for president, both of them have clinched their respective nominations in their parties. You know what will happen between now and November? It'll be a fun ride. I'll be quite honest. It'll be a fun ride. It'll be a frustrating ride for some, and a triumphal ride for others, and maybe just frustrating for everybody. We have our senatorial candidates picked. We have our House of Representatives candidates picked. We have all the people that came through. I'm disappointed in who got picked in our state house race, because I am represented, unfortunately, by a member of the Blue 22. Barry Sheets and I talked about this when it happened last year, the Blue 22. Blue 22, I'm not going to explain that. Mike O'Reilly and I talked about that on Thursday on Talk of the Town, and Mike didn't know what the Blue 22 were. The Blue 22 are 22 Republicans who joined with Democrats to frankly install what I would call a rhino Republican in name only Speaker of the House. We're not going to talk about that today either. I've given you about as much as I'm going to give you. What I want to talk about, a question that came up, and why is it so frustrating on especially national elections? Why is it so easy? One of the reasons, this isn't the whole reason, why is it so easy to steal an election? Am I implying that I believe the 2020 election was stolen? Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. I'm not implying that. I'm stating it out. It was stolen. There's no doubt about that. More and more evidence of theft mostly by I've had friends who in the past have talked about, oh, we need to go to paper ballots. We need to go to paper ballots. We need to go to paper ballots. Forget the machine voting. Well, was machine voting involved in the theft? Yes, it was. But that election was stolen by paper ballot, by mail-in ballots. And the excuse given was the pandemic, was COVID. And if you'll recall, in 2020, we were in the midst of it, and a whole bunch of election rules got, essentially got suspended. And we had activists who were, especially on the left, who were doing things like ballot harvesting. And that what that means is you went around. All, if you recall, in Ohio, we all got paper ballots. We all got mail-ins, whether we wanted them or not. There we were encouraged to use those rather than showing up for in-person voting. And what would happen was people would go around to older people's homes, they would go to mental health facilities, they would go to retirement homes, they would go to places where they knew people would probably be registered to vote. And even if they weren't, there were a lot of people who really weren't legitimately registered to vote who voted in 2020. And they would go around and they would, especially with people who are not completely with it mentally, would quote unquote help them fill out their ballot, and then would collect that ballot and mail it in for them. Now, I know this happened, can't prove it, but you and I both know this happened. If they had someone who had their full faculties and just couldn't easily get someplace where they could drop off their ballot, if they voting for candidates in the wrong column, shall we say, they would simply either refuse to collect their ballot or collect it and destroy it. And we also had problems with military ballots being disqualified for the stupidest reasons you can imagine. I can remember secretaries of state saying, these people are, we don't really permit them to vote because, you know, they didn't dot an I across the T. Meanwhile, they got mimeographed mail-in ballots and everything was just fine. No problem. That kind of thing. So did that method get used to steal elections? Of course it did. And where do you see it most prominently? Well, you saw it in places like Chicago, which is nothing new for Chicago. There is a the 1960 election was won. It was very close, Nixon versus Kennedy, and it was very close, and it got down to the wire, and the vote from Chicago was not in yet. And there's a reason for that, because basically Illinois was very close. And election officials in Chicago simply asked, how many votes do you need for Kennedy to put us over the top? And a number was come up with, and that's, what do you know, that's the number that Chicago supplied to bring Illinois over the top on those votes, on the votes necessary to take the entire state. And one of the things we're going to talk about today, what made that easy is we have a system in this country in 48 states. And that system is winner take all. If you want to win a majority of the votes in a state, then you take all the electors in the state. Remember that when you vote for a presidential candidate, you are not really voting for that candidate. You are voting for a slate of electors who go to the Electoral College in Columbus. It's held in the state capitol. You go to the state capitol and you cast your ballot for the candidate that you have pledged for. I have been on an electoral slate. I was a electoral candidate. Unfortunately, I was on the electoral slate for a third party candidate who really had no chance. Nonetheless, we put our time, effort, and money into it. Why? Because we wanted to steer policy. And if we got enough votes, we might have a say in policy. So I was on an electoral slate for a third-party candidate, which means that if you voted for that candidate, and we had somehow, through some miracle of the Lord, had won the state, I would have gone to Columbus gone to the state house and cast my ballot for my pledged candidate. Now, does that mean that I absolutely, there are any number of scenarios you can think of. What if my candidate had died between the time that I was selected as for the slate of electors and it was time for me to go to Columbus to vote? Well, that's a good question. And an elector then must vote his conscience. Now, some states have laws where electors must cast their ballot for the candidate that they are pledged to. Other states allow, and this was the original intent, by the way, other states allow electors to cast the ballot according to their conscience. Now, most people's consciences, that you know, they pledge to a specific candidate. This is not the plan that was originally, and we're going to talk about that. I'm hoping to get that far today. This is going to be a multi-part broadcast. This week, we're going to do the first part about the Electoral College. And then next week, we're going to have Catherine Wood from Relationships Under Construction to come on and talk about the RUC banquet, the Relationships Under Construction banquet, which you heard an advertisement for at the beginning of this program, this podcast or program, and you will hear it again at the end, because I embed them into this program. And if you're not hearing it, you're listening to a rerun. This is for the 2024 banquet. And we do need your help, and we would love for you to come to sit in our banquet. We have a couple of spots left open at our table. When I say our, I mean mine. Barry Sheets used to always have at least one, usually two tables. Currently, I have one. I would like to have more. But we would love for you to come. Villa Milano, April 9th in the evening. Starting around, I think around 6. Nonetheless, you can find out for yourself. It's, relationshipsunderconstruction.com. Go to the events choice and sign up to, come to the banquet. And it'll choose your menu item, put in your information, and tell them you would like to sit at my table. It's very simple. Very, very simple. It's relationshipsunderconstruction.com or rucinc.org. rucinc.org or relationshipsunderconstruction.com. Okay, that being said, let's get to it, because what I'm going to do is give you some information. I did a lecture at Camp American, oh gosh, about 10 years ago, about 10 years ago, on the Electoral College, and it was called Original Intent, How It Has Changed and Why It Still Works. And we're gonna talk about, you know, I've done my God and Government thing. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the basic history of why things were set up the way they are. So we won't get rolling into the real mechanics until a little later on. We might get to it today. In any case, there's an interesting book, and as I recall, it's free at Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S, Mises.org. And it's called Reassessing the Presidency, the Rise of the Executive State, and the Decline of Freedom. You can tell from that title, they're not pulling any punches. They think that an overly strong executive branch basically is dangerous to freedom, and frankly, I agree with that. This was a compilation of presentations. I have the audios from it. It's very good. It's edited by a guy named John Denson, who is hooked up with Mises.org. It's the Electoral College as a Restraint on American Democracy. It's an evolution from Washington to Jackson. It's a lecture given by a guy named Randall G. Holcomb, and it's a paper. And again, you can get it for free from Mises.org. He states that the fundamental principle of government in 1787 was liberty. And he defines that. Liberty to the founders meant freedom from government oppression, where governmental power was limited by law based on higher authority. What higher authority? That's the question, isn't it? It's based on higher authority. In other words, the form of government they were working to establish was a constitutional republic. A constitutional republic has a constitution which limits the authority of the central government. And we have state constitutions which limit the authority of the state government. And we have charters at the county level that limit the authority of the county government. And we have charters at the township level, which limit the authority of the township government. Same with cities, same name a governmental entity. They have governing documents that limit their authority. They are not to give them specific powers. When the Constitution begins to give specific powers, it's dangerous. Now, of course, you have to grant some authority. Like our Constitution grants specific authority for, well, we'll get to this. So the United States was founded as a constitutional republic, wherein the federal government would have a limited set of powers and very specifically limited and outlined. All right. What did the framers think of limited constitutional republic? Now, one of the most influential founders that you've probably never heard of is James Otis. He wrote very powerful arguments in pamphlets such as The Rights of the British Colonies, Asserted and Proved, in 1763. Remember, this is 12 years before the revolution started. It was written to oppose the writs of assistance and had a profound influence on men such as John Adams, Samuel Adams, John Hancock. You recognize all those names, I hope, from American history. If you don't, then, well, maybe you should have me come in and teach a homeschool class or something. Here's what he wrote. Quote, to say that the Parliament is absolute and arbitrary is a contradiction. The Parliament cannot make 2 plus 2, 5. Omnipotency cannot do it. The supreme power in a state is jus dicere, or to declare what the law is, only. Jus dare, to make the law, strictly speaking, belongs alone to God. This is the one of our most important founding fathers saying legislative bodies can't really make law. They declare what the law already is and outline its parameters. Back to it. Quote, parliaments are in all cases to declare what is parliament that makes it so. There must in every case be a higher authority, that is God. Should an act of Parliament be against any of his natural laws, which are immutably true, their declaration would be contrary to eternal truth, equity, and justice. Those are a couple of terms that get floated around these days, but look in the context. And consequently void, and so it would be adjudged by the Parliament itself when convinced of their mistake. Upon this great principle, parliaments repeal such acts as soon as they find they have been mistaken. When was the last time that happened? In having declared them to be for the public good when in fact they are not so. How many laws are on the books that declare themselves to be good for the public good but really aren't? Now, in 2024, democracy has a meaning, democracy meaning that all law and public policy is based preferably on a consensus of public opinion, but if no consensus, then majority opinion. There is no higher law except the will and whim of public opinion. You now see when you hear people say, we do not live in a democracy, we live in a republic. That is the crux of the difference. Right there. There's no higher law except the will and whim of public opinion. Now, are there different types of democratic government? Yes, there are. There are many different types of democratic government. Direct democracy. In a direct democracy, law and public policy are passed and implemented by public meetings in which all qualified citizens participate and vote. Now, obviously, that only works on a very small scale. Good luck trying to get everybody in the United States together to engage in public meetings at one time, all qualified citizens at once, and get them to vote. Obviously, that's impossible. We have 6 hours worth of time differences within the 50 states of the United States of America. I've had enough trouble in my business when I have people, I get calls from people from Hawaii and call me back. Well, it usually means that they've called me at 3 o'clock in the afternoon their time, but it's 9 o'clock where I am. I have the same problem with Alaska. Now, it's not so bad. I think the time difference is four hours, depending on where you are in Alaska. Now, you get out in the Aleutians, you're way out there. I don't get too many calls from them. I get major cities, Juneau, Fairbanks, that kind of thing. But it's 4 or 5 hours difference. And so getting people, how would you do it? Now, we live in an age when you could, I suppose, get everybody electronically hooked up. But how are you going to do a Zoom call with 300 and somewhere between 325 and 340 million people, depending on how many people you think have snuck across the border? How are you going to do that? And how do you determine if they're all citizens or not and eligible to participate in the government? That again, that only works on a small scale. A small town might be able to pull this off. You'll find that most small towns still don't do it that way. I'm sure you could find one somewhere, maybe in New Hampshire or Vermont, that does it that way. But most places would not do it that way. Okay. This only works on a very small scale. A democratic republic. Okay. A democratic republic. A republic means rule by law. And democratic means majority rule. So the will of the people is implemented by elected representatives, also called a representative democracy. Okay, the will of the people, again, without access or appealing to higher law. It's simply the will of the people. Now, since we did a brief foray into republicanism, and now we're going into democracy, as you've heard. What did the founders think about democracy? Well, James Madison said the following: from the view of the subject, it may be concluded that a pure democracy, by which I mean a society consisting of a small number of citizens who assemble and administer the government in person, can admit of no cure for the mischiefs of faction. What did he mean by faction? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. A common passion or interest will, in almost every case, be felt by a majority of the whole. A communication and concert result from the form of government itself, and there is nothing to check the inducements to sacrifice the weaker party or an obnoxious individual. In other words, we'll isolate and destroy, if we have to, outliers. James Madison continued, hence, it is that such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, for obvious reasons. That's my take. Back to Madison, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. Theoretic politicians who have patronized this species of government have erroneously supposed that by reducing mankind to a perfect equality, what are we dealing with in society right now? An attempt to make everybody equal. In their political rights, they would at the same time be perfectly equalized and assimilated in their possessions, their opinions, and their passions. John Adams said, remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. Democracy will soon degenerate into an anarchy, such an anarchy that every man will do what is right in his own eyes. Yes, Book of Judges, folks. And no man's life or property or reputation or liberty will be secure, and every one of these will soon mold itself into a system of subordination of all the moral virtues and intellectual abilities, all the powers of wealth, beauty, wit, and science to the wanton pleasures, the capricious will, and the execrable or abominable cruelty of one or a very few. In other words, it would devolve into a dictatorship. Now, what did Madison mean by a faction? By a faction, he says, by this quote, "By a faction, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest adverse to the rights of other citizens, or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community." Now, to translate that into modern language, groups whose sole aim is to be granted rights and or privileges that, while appearing to be good for that group, damage society overall. Now, there are modern factions, and I'll go through a short list. Some, but not definitely not all, and I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but some, not all, labor union activities. Environmental activists, groups seeking special rights for abnormal sexual orientation. Remember, I put this lecture together in 2014. I could see this coming. Not a prophet or a son of a prophet, but it was easy to see that this was from the preceding, that this was going to be where it went. Groups seeking changes to traditional marriage. Folks, we're there. Any group seeking to involve the federal government in injecting itself in areas constitutionally forbidden to it. We're all over that. With the federal government being able to dictate whether or not you should be allowed to have an internal combustion engine in lieu of an electric car, that will be very close to useless for many of us. Fine for going back and forth in town, but if you want to make a long trip, good luck. Now, what other proof is there that the framers wanted to avoid democracy? And they did want to avoid democracy. When I say the framers, I mean those who wrote the Articles of Confederation and wrote the Constitution, because those are both constitutions by different names. They have different activities and different amounts of power they assigned to the federal government. Nonetheless, they were both documents that set out powers and limited them. All right, what other proof is there? Now, I would ask you a question. What portion of the federal government could it be said to be elected, quote-unquote, democratically? Well, currently only one-third of the federal government is democratically elected. One-third. Under the original intent of the Constitution, only one-sixth of the federal government was democratically elected. Where are you getting those numbers? There are three branches of government: one-third executive, one-third judicial, one-third legislative. Okay? Half of the legislative branch was elected democratically before 1913. Which half? The House of Representatives. One half of one-third is one-sixth. Therefore, until the 17th Amendment, which mandated that senators be chosen democratically, the legislative branch faction changed from 1/6 to 1/3. Why? Because before that, senators were chosen by decree of the state government. Did some state governments choose to let people elect their state senators? Yeah, that happened. That was not the norm. So one-third were democratically elected. Now, the analogy is somewhat imperfect. Now, you'll say, well, you left out the president. Yeah, he's not democratically elected specifically. He's elected by electors. There's a barrier in between. Now, this analogy is imperfect. It presumes that each branch has essentially equal power to provide checks and balances to government. There are major problems with this idea. Any member of any branch of government may be removed from office by action of Congress, including senators and congressmen. Senators have the right to remove senators who are deemed to be unworthy of the job. The House of Representatives can remove members. It just did so. Just this year, late last year, early this year, it removed a fellow from New York who was an egregious, liar and a crook. And it has happened recently. Now, the fact that other members of the House who should be removed for being crooks, liars, engaged with foreign entities and passing national secrets to foreign entities. Eric Swalwell basically was dating a Chinese national who it turned out was an agent, they were more than dating. They were having a deep relationship. She was determined was a foreign agent, a foreign spy. And he was very intimate with this woman, and it seems past her secrets. And yet he retains his job, and he's trying to do, and he did everything he could to get rid of Donald Trump, with a false accusation of being a Russian agent. But he's not the only one. Mitch McConnell is very suspect with his relationship with his wife, who we won't go into that. But in any case, we've now scored one for congressional authority. Congress can remove judges. They can impeach and remove a judge from office. So they can discipline their own offices, senators and congressmen. Now, a congressman cannot discipline a senator. And a senator cannot discipline a congressman. It has to be done by the House that they're sitting in, the chamber. Another problem with this is the idea the president has the power of veto, but Congress may override that power. Congress can also remove a president, as we saw an attempt to do twice with Donald Trump, although the second time could not be really considered an impeachment. Donald Trump had already left office. You can't impeach a president when he's not sitting in office. It's only specifically for office holders, current office holders. So the second one was a joke. Everybody knew it was a joke. And again, the Senate refused to, the Senate said it was a joke. But nonetheless, the president has the power of the veto, but Congress may override that power. So again, Congress can override a presidential veto. It gets done occasionally. Congress has the bulk of the authority in this case. It presumes that each problems with the idea the federal courts can find federal laws unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction in only a limited number of cases. A lot of people don't know that. And Congress can restrict federal court authority to hear cases outside these bounds. Lower courts exist at the will of Congress, as do the existence of all Supreme Court justices below the Chief Justice. Folks, if you don't know this, there's one Supreme Court justice who is mandated by the Constitution. That's the Chief Justice. The number of justices on the Supreme Court is set by Congress. the number and type of courts underneath the Supreme Court is set by Congress. So, and the authority that those courts can exercise in hearing suits against certain laws are set by Congress. And that power has been used as recently as the 1990s in a forestry bill. Tom Daschle from, I think, North Dakota, got a forestry bill passed, and he removed the ability of the Supreme Court to hear cases on its constitutionality. And it's been done in the past. There are cases that people have brought things to the Supreme Court, and they've taken a look at it and read the law and said, as much as we would like to rule on this, we can't because we've been stripped of the authority and it doesn't match our specific powers that can't be controlled by Congress. It happens. So that's 2 points for congressional authority. So far, who's got all the power? Congress does. Why is that? Well, we'll talk about that. Until the 15th Amendment. First of all, democracy assumes universal suffrage. Do we have universal suffrage in this country? We do not. Till the 15th Amendment, the power to define the requirements for voting was reserved to the states. And the 15th Amendment came out for very good reasons. Black people, former slaves, were being kept from voting. But also, in the North, black people, free blacks, were being kept from voting. Whether they owned property, whether they had businesses, they were restricted from voting. So that particular power was removed by the 15th Amendment. Different states had very different suffrage requirements, but nearly all of them required property ownership at minimum. Why? Because if you own property, you are participating in society. They essentially did not want people who were simply living on the dole, and there was a dole. It was very small. But for the most part, most people owned property. Most people owned property. They had productive farms, or they had productive factories, or they had jobs which allowed them to buy a small home and some property. Most people were eligible to vote on that basis. A significant percentage were ineligible to vote, though, because they couldn't meet minimum suffrage requirements. Why would you want only taxpayers to vote? Well, because you end up in a situation where people, you set up a system where people are taking things from the government. The government is giving them things, and in order to get their vote, they will give them bigger benefits, and who pays it? The taxpayer does. If you restrict those people from having the right to vote, they can no longer vote themselves benefits out of the public pocket. Okay, lack of universal suffrage is a powerful counter to the argument that the framers designed a representative democracy instead of a limited constitutional republic. And remember, we talked about the difference between those two at the front. The most democratically responsive body, the House of Representatives, holds the most constitutionally delegated power. All you got to do is read the Constitution. They have the most delegated power. Now, has the executive branch usurped that a lot of that authority? Oh, you bet they have. You bet they have. Nonetheless, the most constitutionally given is to the House. But isn't the president elected by a majority vote? Well, let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard of these presidents? Albert Gore Jr., Samuel J. Tilden. You would have, by the way, Albert Gore, if you, those of us who are old enough to remember, it's not that long ago, it's 24 years ago, Albert Gore Jr., 2000, won a majority of the popular vote. And Samuel J. Tilden in 1876, by the way, one of the most corrupt, you think 2020 was corrupt, 1876 was horrifically corrupt. Some of the same issues popped up, and we should have used it as a guidepost, but we didn't. Samuel J. Tilden was elected by the popular vote, but he did not win on the electoral vote. And by the way, the idea that somehow it all had to be wrapped up by January 20th, or January 6th, I believe was the, but it all had to be wrapped up by the 20th. Oh my gosh, the 1876 election went on and on and on and on. Now, in those days, the inauguration day was in April, not in January. The inauguration day being moved from April to January was, oh gosh, during Franklin Roosevelt, one of Franklin Roosevelt's terms. And they figured he's going to be president anyway, so what date, what does it matter when we move the date? You may have heard of, you've never heard of these presidents. Why? Because they were not elected by a majority of the popular vote. There's others. There are others. We'll talk about those. Both these men won the popular vote. All right. Did you know these presidents also lost presidential races in which they won the popular vote? Andrew Jackson in 1824 and Grover Cleveland in 1888. I think in this series, I talked about why it was important to understand what happened, especially to Grover Cleveland. Okay. And did you know that very often pluralities, the largest percentage of votes among more than two candidates of well under 50% can win a presidential race? This is in popular vote now, plurality. Bill Clinton got 43% of the popular vote in 1992. Richard Nixon got 43% in 1968. Woodrow Wilson got 42% in 1912. Abraham Lincoln got 40% in 1860. What makes it possible for a candidate to get such low percentages of the popular vote and win the presidency? And it's the Electoral College. The Electoral College is a safeguard against that kind of chaos. So how did the framers decide how to elect a president? Now, there are design considerations. And we've talked about some of them already. Righteous fear of direct democracy. They had a righteous fear of that. And they explained why in those quotes from Adams and Madison. Righteous fear of direct democracy eliminates direct election of the chief executive by a popular vote, and it reduces the influence of faction. Again, that's a special interest, with what we would call it today. So how did the framers decide how to elect a president? They desired to give the state governments a strong voice in the choice. That was an absolute necessity when the Constitution was being written. The small and large states each had goals, and they wanted to give every state a say in how the president was elected. Because remember, in the early days of the Republic, people had very little contact with the federal government. Virtually the only contact they had was through the post office. There was no income tax. Regulatory laws were not yet in vogue. So they had very, very little. Sometimes if there was a war, you might get called up, but you would be called up by your state militia. And then you would serve under a federal head, very often a general, but very often those generals were chosen from among the militia. So we did not have standing armies per se. If we had defensive needs, the militias got called up and the states were in control. Okay. the desire of the small states to avoid being overwhelmed by the large states. That had to be a design consideration in the Electoral College. And the desire to keep single states from dominating the executive branch. This was a big deal. Why? Because states like Virginia could easily, and New York, could easily have lorded it over the smaller states like Rhode Island, Connecticut, Delaware, name Pennsylvania at the time. Pennsylvania is a big state now, but at the time it was not particularly large. It doesn't sound all that difficult, does it? The election of the president turned out to be one of the most contentious issues at the Constitutional Convention. Debate lasted from June to September, virtually the entire term of the Constitutional Convention, and it proceeded in several stages. There are nearly as many proposals for the choosing of the president as there are debate stages about it. The question and proposed solutions were gathered up and put in the lap of a committee called the Committee of 11. What emerged after much work and debate is the following. This is Article 2, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. Now, this is one part that's been changed by the 12th Amendment. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. And they shall make a list of all the persons voted for and of the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the President, and if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, and if there be more than one who have such majority and have an equal number of votes, then the House of Representatives shall immediately choose by ballot one of them for President, and if no person have a majority, then from the five highest on the list, the said House shall in like manner choose the President. But in choosing the President, the votes shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. So in the early days, 13 states, if there had been a tie and they had to go back to voting in the House, the representatives from each state would get together and pick one candidate. So there you go. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from 2/3 of the states, and a majority of all the states shall be necessary to a choice. In every case, after the choice of president, the person having the greatest number of votes of the electors shall be the vice president. But if there should remain two or more who have equal votes, the Senate shall choose from them by ballot the vice president. And again, those last sections that I read are altered by the 12th Amendment. The Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. Okay, see how Congress says when you have to go to your state capital to cast your vote. They are in control of that, not the state legislators and state legislatures. The Congress decides, and it has to be the same throughout the entire United States. Now, take a note that each state has a minimum number of electors. It's equal to the number of members of the House of Representatives and their two senators. Each state has a complete authority of how electors are chosen, with the exception that electors cannot be concurrently a federal employee or elected federal official. You can be a state official, and you can be a state employee, and serve as an elector. You may not do so as a federal employee. And the if you think it through, you'll see why that is. It makes perfect sense. Each elector votes for two candidates. This is very important. Were you pledged to a slate of candidates? No, you were not. You were simply on a slate of electors that got elected. You can see how it evolved into slates of electors pledged to candidates. But at first, it was not. You simply chose men who you believed could make the proper decision and voted for them, and they decided who should be the president. Well, actually, they didn't decide who should be the president and the vice president. They cast two votes, and it was not specific for the president or the vice president. They cast two, and the majority getter was the president, and the next one down was the vice president. Now, did they send it off that way to Congress? No, they sent it off as two votes. And we'll talk about the details of that, why it sounds weird, because we haven't done that in over well over 100, almost 200 years. All right, note that electors meet in their respective states. No elector can vote for two candidates from his own state. This is a very important consideration in keeping states like Virginia, New York, larger states, from overwhelming the smaller states. A majority of electors, and by the way, that still holds. You still can't have a president and a vice president from the same state. A majority of electors, not a plurality, is required for election of a president. In other words, you got to have 50% plus one. Nothing else will work. If no majority of electoral votes is achieved by a candidate, then the president is chosen by the House of Representatives. Remember, the Senate counts the votes. But if there's a tie vote, it goes to the House. The House must choose from the top five Electoral College votes. Later, it's changed. Actually, it's not. It's still the same. If there is a majority tie vote in the Electoral College, the tiebreaker goes to the House of Representatives. A quorum of at least one member of the delegations of two-thirds of the states must be present for a vote to be held. In other words, you got to have a quorum, and the quorum is set at 67% of the states. I remember this was in a day and age when it was hard to get to D.C. Really wasn't that easy, you know, from remote areas like Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina. It was tough. Each state delegation in the House casts a single vote for president, and a majority of states present, not a plurality, is required for election of a president in the House. In order that for some of what follows to make sense, one has to understand the following. In the 18th and 19th centuries, people did not view the states and their relationship to the federal government as we do today. Each state was considered to be a sovereign nation with a common federal government for the purposes of defense, diplomacy, and trade. This is federalism. This is what I talked about earlier, that there were specific powers granted to the federal government, and they all revolved around defense, diplomacy, and trade. That was the purview of the federal government, and that was so all the states could be protected. They were not allowed to charge one another import and export duties, which sovereign nations can do. They surrendered that part of their sovereignty to the federal government because that had been a problem under the Articles of Confederation, which is one of the reasons we got the Constitution instead. Okay, small history lesson. I'm going to run out of time before I get too much further, so let's go on. This is federalism we're talking about, folks. Each state was considered to be a sovereign nation with a common federal government for the purposes of defense, diplomacy, and trade. The residents of individual states had a sense of national pride in their home state, much as people now feel about the United States as a whole. The original design of the Electoral College then accomplished the following. It eliminates direct democratic election of the president. No constitutional right to vote for president. There wasn't one. There's no constitutional right. And there wasn't by the anything up to the 12th Amendment either. Electors vote for president. States completely control the choice of their electors. Framers hoped the states would choose electors on the basis of their wisdom and ability to judge the character and leadership skills of the candidates. It gave all the states a voice in choice of the president. Every state gets a minimum number of electors. Every state or single states cannot dominate elections. Every elector gets two votes and must vote for someone not a resident of his state. It puts a damper on the power of faction. Electors meet in individual states, which greatly reduces the influence of consensus building. Most electors expected to vote for one home state candidate and one whom they had a high opinion of from another, probably a regional state. Even then, we had the idea of regional states, states that we had contiguous borders with. Factions in individual states and even regional factions could be dampened by candidates from other states, and that is easy to see. Now, in the first election for president, everyone expected one man to be the first president, and that was George Washington. Washington was elected by a unanimous Electoral College vote twice. The only president to have that done, there was one who had the support to be a unanimous choice of the Electoral College, and that was James Monroe. But someone stepped up, one elector stepped up, and voted for someone else to keep Washington the only one who got unanimous support. The consensus of opinion on what would happen after Washington was 19, this is a quote from George Mason at the Constitutional Convention, 19 times in 20, the president would be chosen by the Senate. Think about this. This is when we had 13 states. If every elector from each of the 13 states voted for the same home state favorite and one favorite from another state, how many candidates at a minimum would receive electoral votes? Well, think about it for a minute. How many states are there? 13. If everybody voted for one state candidate and one favorite from another, you'd have a minimum of 13 if everybody respected all the same individuals. You'd have a minimum of 13 votes. Okay? What are the chances that one candidate would achieve a majority, 50% plus one, of electoral votes under this model? Well, it's a very poor, if you think about it. The fact that it didn't work that way came as a shock to everybody. The framers believed that the Electoral College would provide a slate of the best candidates available. And then that from that candidate slate, the top five electoral vote getters are the list from which the House of Representatives must choose the president and vice president. The framers expected the House to choose the president in 19 times out of 20. So how did this thinking work out? In 1796, Vice President John Adams got a majority of Electoral College votes in a field of 13 candidates. That's using that system we just talked about. In 1800, Vice President Thomas Jefferson defeated President John Adams with a majority of Electoral College votes in a field of 4 candidates. The only time, I'm going to stop here, the only time the system worked the way the framers envisioned, with the Electoral College providing a list of candidates with the top 3, which was changed by the 12th Amendment from the top 5 candidates, going to the House of Representatives for their choice, was in the election of 1824. They chose John Quincy Adams over Andrew Jackson and William Crawford. We'll start out with Amendment 12 next week. You know what I think. I want to know what you think. I want you to seriously consider joining me at my table for the Relationships Under Construction Banquet, April 9th. And again, joining me again next week for another Principles and Policies.
What's going on in the present affects our future, our tomorrows. Did you know that RUC provides help in preparing the tomorrows for our children? We're excited to invite you to the 15th annual RUC fundraising banquet on April 9th, where we'll present The Tomorrow Show. Our banquet will be held at the Villa Milano, with festivities beginning at 5:30, dinner is at 6:30, and the program gets underway at 7. Make your reservations today at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.